We'll proceed to the fifth case, Bensky v. Powell. Mr. Bensky.
May it please the court, good morning.
My name is Lawrence Bensky. I represent my brother, David Bensky.
This is a declaratory judgment action for a declaration of U.S. nationality. The underlying...
Why does he want to get his U.S. citizenship back?
Excuse me?
Why does he want his... Does he live in the United States now, or what?
No, he hasn't lived here since 1964.
Well, why does he want citizenship?
I don't know.
Is he planning to come back to the United States? Just a portfolio of citizenships.
It's certainly not in the record, and I certainly that's a question
just
that
an
I
idle
guess.
Curiosity.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to get back here. He comes here very often. It could have an impact on his children's citizenship. I have another brother who was in the Israeli army after the Ephraim decision, and because of that, he was not subject to the same mistake of law.
Right.
His three children do have American citizenship. My niece
okay.
just went. So, but it's a question I've asked him many times, and I haven't gotten a straight answer. The underlying claim, which I would like to get to, of course, in the trial court, is that he renounced his American citizenship in 1964 based on a mistake of law. Mistake acknowledged by the State Department, by the U.S. government. So therefore, his decision to renounce was not voluntary and was not made with the specific intent to relinquish his American citizenship. But I have a long way to go before I get there. This district court dismissed the case on the grounds of subject matter jurisdiction, and we have appealed that. Not sure whether it really is subject matter jurisdiction, but the underlying issue is clear, and that is whether the claim is barred by a statute of limitations. And I really don't think it matters under the posture of the case whether it's considered jurisdictional or simply based on sort of a motion to dismiss for a failure to state a claim. There are four real possible dates of accrual of this claim, two of which have been argued, three of which. One is September 23rd of 1964, the date that the Certificate of Loss of Nationality was approved. The second is the one that we contend is the appropriate accrual of the claim, is November 24th of 1998, which was the denial of the appellant's passport application. In the briefing, the government suggested that another date might be June 2nd, I believe, of 1987, when the Board of Appellate Review denied the claim, dismissed the claim based on a completely separate statute.
Going back to 1964, if your brother had wanted to challenge the this denationalization at that point, what remedies were open to him, would have been open to him?
After he
has this interview with a consular officer and exercises and executes this renunciation, he changes his mind. What could he have done back then?
I think he could have done two things. I think he could have appealed to some entity which was the predecessor of the current Board of Appellate Review. The board's decision in the appendix refers to that predecessor agency. The second thing he could have done is he could have brought an action under 8 U.S.C. Section 1503 for a declaration that he had not lost his U.S. citizenship. And we think he could have done it. Well, he might have been able to do that, but not under 1503. Then it would have been under the Administrative Procedure Act. He could have sought a passport. He could have sought some kind of item identifying him as an American citizen. And once it was denied, he could have sued under 1503. And that is the critical distinction, I think, that the Whitehead Court was trying to set. The fourth date, which is a possible date for accrual of the cause of action, which has not been argued in any of the briefs, I raise it because there's a potential subject matter jurisdiction issue, and that is the date of the enactment of the amendment to 8 U.S.C. Section 1501, which where Congress explicitly stated that the approval of the Certificate of Loss of Nationality.
Well, if you construe that amendment as a change in the statute of limitations, you'd only have a reasonable time thereafter to make his claim, wouldn't it?
Well, that was why I'm surprised it hasn't been argued below, because that's a concern. But it's still, under the statute, the conduct has occurred in 1964. That's the conduct that we're talking about.
No, but and the general rule as to statutes of limitations, if you change the statute of limitations, you only have a reasonable time after the change to bring your lawsuit. Isn't that right?
Well, certainly there's no citations that I've seen to that effect in any of the arguments, and it seems to me that you still have to comply with the statute, and the statute does not provide the appropriate notice which would be necessary to trigger, in theory, not obviously in practice, but in theory, to trigger the accrual of the cause of action. There is nothing in the record suggesting that the certificate of loss of nationality is actually provided to the person, or that he even knows about it. The statute that we're talking about, 8 U.S.C. 1503, covers any type of loss of nationality, whether it's a renunciation, whether it is back at the time voting, whether it is entering the armed services of a foreign nation, whether it is working for a foreign government. If you do that, you are not making a claim of any kind. You are not seeking any kind of relief, and you are not on notice that any time is starting to run. And that's true in 1964 when you take the action, and it's true in 1994 when Congress amends the law. And given that lack of notice, to simply apply a new statute of limitations 25 years later would violate the notice requirements of the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Bensky. Mr. Humphrey.
May it please the Court, my name is Richard Humphrey, and I'm an assistant U.S. attorney from the Western District of Wisconsin. Excuse me. And I represented the defendant, Secretary of State Colin Powell, before the district court in this case. What we're talking about here are really two statutes, Section 1501 and 1503 of Title VIII. Both of those statutes came into being in the year 1952.
Well, when do you think his cause of action accrued?
When the CLN, the Certificate of Loss of Nationality, was issued to him back in on September 23 of 1964.
And then what could he have done then?
Then he would have had five
years to do what?
Right, 5 years in which to file a suit in the district court.
Now, what if he argued that, well, it took him 5 years to find out that he had been deceived? Is there any tolling rule that would be applicable?
No. Not that I'm aware of. No.
Why is that?
I just don't think
that. Why wouldn't the normal tolling rules be applicable?
Well, I don't know why it would be told, because otherwise, I mean, here he's saying that he didn't voluntarily relinquish his citizenship. He was under a misunderstanding. And if there's some tolling, then are we saying that this thing could be tolled for 40 years and he could come in then and say...
Well, no, I think that would be pretty unlikely. But I was just wondering, there are various tolling rules, like fraudulent concealment, so something
okay.
like that. So what if they'd concealed from him? Now, this case that said that... So I understand it used to be the law that if you served in a foreign army, you automatically lost your citizenship. That was the original law, wasn't it?
Well, I think that the rule was that if you served in a foreign army that was engaged in hostility with the United States, then you could lose your citizenship.
You just couldn't join foreign armies.
Well, actually, this person did join the Israeli army, but he would not have lost his citizenship just because of that.
At no point?
I don't believe so.
But supposing he was, you know, suppose the consular officer made some... I mean, suppose the consular officer had called him up and said, look, I hear you joined the Israeli army. That means you have to... you have to sign this certificate, otherwise we'll drag you back to the United States, something like that. They say to that's a fraudulent representation. So then couldn't he argue fraudulent concealment, not necessarily for 40 years, but maybe for 6 years, you know, it took him that amount of time to learn that this was a false statement.
If there was actually fraud involved, and you may have a point, I'm really not familiar with exactly when a statute of limitations can be told in something like that. I mean, I have not seen any cases that involve this statute of limitations that involve tolling.
Why did he make this declaration before going into the Israeli army then?
Well, he claims that he thought he was going to lose his citizenship anyway, and so he therefore went into the consular at the American Embassy in Tel Aviv, Israel, and voluntarily...
You don't think he would have lost his citizenship, though, I gather. Is that right?
No, I don't think he would have.
That's news to me, but that's interesting.
Well, this is under... I'm referring to section, I think it's 1485, which gives the different activities that somebody might engage in, thereby leading to their expatriation. In other words, it's not always that a certificate of loss of nationality is issued, like in this case where there's been a voluntary renunciation. If you engage in certain activities like becoming a member of a foreign government or in some circumstances serving with a foreign army and so on, then the consular, if that comes to his attention, he can decide that a CLN should be issued. And then one would be issued.
I have the same impression. I think Judge Cuddy did. These are new rules. Wasn't there a time where if you had citizenship in a foreign country, you automatically lost your U.S. citizenship? Didn't we used to forbid dual citizenship? No?
I can't answer that. I don't know. But here I think that he could have had, at least at this time, which is 1964, he could have been an Israeli citizen and also a citizen of the United States.
Right.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, there's a lot
and I don't
of
think that the plaintiff has ever argued otherwise.
What's the effect of this 94 amendment?
Well, all that amendment did, consistent with the Hoyer decision, is it just made Section 1503 more clear. The amendment is actually in 1501, but it was intended to just make the meaning or the interpretation of 1503 more clear. That's all that it did. The statute, both these statutes came into being in 1952, and they meant the same thing from that date all the way up until and even beyond when the amendment came into being. The only reason for that amendment was because of those couple of cases, the Whitehead case and the Maldonado-Sanchez case that are cited in the briefs. But both of those cases, the Hoyer Court out of the 11th Circuit had already disagreed with and said that they were clearly wrong. Although the Hoyer decision came before the statute, just before the statute was actually amended, but the only reason for the amendment was because of the Whitehead case primarily, but also the Maldonado-Sanchez case.
Suppose the 94 amendment had shortened the statute of limitations. Would there be a retroactivity problem there?
Well, that might then be a... Well, it depends whether you look at that. I don't think that we have to look at retroactivity in this case because my...
I'm giving you another case.
Right. Well, it depends whether you look at a change in the statute, the length of the statute, as being procedural or substantive. My argument would be that that's just a procedural change, and normally procedural changes can be used retroactively. In any event, if you look at the legislative history of Section 1503 and 1501, you find that Senator Kennedy had said that the amendment would make clear that the issuance of a CLN is a final administrative action subject to judicial review. So based on that, I think it's clear then that the 1994 amendment was only there just to make the statute more clear. It didn't change the meaning, it only clarified it. And that the meaning is exactly the same as what the Hoyer Court had come up with. That was a 1994 decision, and 1994, of course, is the year of the amendment. But both the amendment and the Hoyer Court are interpreting Section 1503 in the exact same way. The problem came in when the Whitehead case said that, well, when a CLN is issued, that's just a ministerial act, or it's just a rubber stamp, and it's not the product of an administrative proceeding, and it's not a final administrative determination. But the Hoyer Court said, no, that's wrong, because clearly there was an administrative proceeding. There was the oath of renunciation in that case, just as here. The consular at the embassy had certified the CLN. He sent it off to the Secretary of State, and it had to be then reviewed and then approved. That was discretionary, whether or not to approve it, but it was approved. And an administrative appeal was available in Whitehead, even though Whitehead did not take advantage of it. So this has all of the earmarks of an administrative proceeding, especially the fact that there's an administrative appeal available. So I think Whitehead, it just has muddled reasoning in it, and it's just plain wrong. That case was out of the Third Circuit. There was one other...
The 87 date, the proper one then. There certainly was an administrative proceeding then.
And that would be fine with the government if that were to be used as the triggering date for the statute, because this man waited from 1964 all the way till 1985 to file an administrative appeal. In 1987, the decision was issued, and clearly there was finality at that point. So even if you use that date, then the statute would have run in 1992, which is still 12 years ago. I think that the Maldonado-Sanchez case is also wrong. All that one held was that the Secretary's approval of a CLN was not the denial of a right. It was simply the granting of a right to renounce citizenship, which to me and to the Hoyer Court is nothing but a play on words. And I think the Maldonado case is just as wrong as the Whitehead case was. And since the Hoyer case was more recent than either of those two, and it rejected both of those cases, I'm urging this court to do the same, to adopt Hoyer as the district court here did, and find that the district court's decision dismissing the complaint with prejudice and with costs should be affirmed. And I see my time has run out, but I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Bensky.
Thank you. I certainly hope that this court
takes the opportunity to make the decision that you were just requested, which is whether or not the Hoyer case reasoning or the Whitehead and Maldonado case reasoning is better. If this court reached the circuit split, I think that you'll have to decide in favor of the Whitehead case. I do want to correct some things. I think you're absolutely correct. The belief always was, prior to Ephraim v. Rusk, that you could not have dual citizenship. There is no question. It's alleged in paragraph 8 of our complaint, to the extent that it's a factual allegation, the court must accept it. To the extent that it's legal, I think it will be obvious when you go back and look at 8 U.S.C. 1481. I believe at the time, entering a foreign army did result in loss of citizenship. It was automatic.
All the Americans who participated with what would be our allies before World War II, whether it's the Flying Tigers or flying with the RAF, all those people lost their citizenship?
I don't know if they did. I'm saying the statute would be entry into the armed service of a foreign nation. Not being drafted. It has to be voluntary.
Yeah, no,
I think
our history shows us participation in World War I or World War II in advance of our actual declaration of war of American flying.
Well,
and
that's a good question. I don't know that, but I do know that the voluntary, even the current law today, talks about non-commissioned or commissioned officers.
Well, did Mr. Bensky, your brother, seek to become a citizen so he could join the army?
He believed that it was clear under American law that if he joined the Israeli army voluntarily, he would lose his American citizenship.
Well, he became a citizen in July.
Right.
And surely, within a couple of weeks, he joins the army.
In order to protect Americans living in Israel, the Israeli government did not make automatic citizenship for people who went there. You could decline. In July, my brother could have declined to become an Israeli citizen. Had he done that, he would have not had to join the Israeli army, and he could have kept the American citizenship. He said he was going to live there. If he's going to live there, he's going to do what's necessary to defend his country, and he was not going to decline the citizenship. He accepted the citizenship, and then he went into the Israeli army, knowing that it was automatic. He also knew that he wanted to come and see his younger brother in the States. And to do that, he didn't want to deceive the government.
Well,
so
in 21 years later, in 85, he feels that he was misled, right?
Right. And there's no element of fraud here, of course. This is
No.
Right.
And in 87, we have the adverse ruling by the board to Mr. Bensky. Now, so why isn't 92 then the date, as Mr. Humphrey?
That's a tough question. But I think it's because the statute, 1503, says that it's not. 8 U.S.C. section 1503A says if any person who was within the U.S. claims a right or privilege. And while he didn't earlier, I guess you could say that his making the appeal to the Board of Appellate Review maybe is a claim.
Well, that's what he's claiming.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I'm assuming, yeah.
And is denied such right by any department or independent agency upon the ground that he is not a national of the United States. There was no such ground. That board determined it did not have subject matter jurisdiction. It dismissed his appeal on the ground of a completely separate statute of limitations. It was not a trigger for 8 U.S.C. section 1503. This is not a case about the good policy of finality. There's no question that this argument is an argument based on the statutes and what he's entitled to under the statutes. And reading the statutes, his claim is timely.
Thank you, Mr. Bensky. Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to